It's a Question of Balance with Bruce Coplin. Featuring stimulating, in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome to the show, where we balance the intellectual with the creative and explore whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect everybody, both locally and globally. And for this, the Arts Hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I really feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. If you'd like to find out more information about the show or listen to previous shows, you can hear podcasts at my website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. And you can also connect with me on social media there, should you wish, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, etc. So again, the show website is itsaquestionofbalance.com. And on the home page, there are tabs at the top with guests and topics. If you click on those, it makes it really easy to browse and choose the podcast that you want. So I do encourage you to go and have a look there. We've had some wonderful guests and some very interesting topics. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing the highly regarded wildlife photographer Jody Frediani. Her images have been featured in local and regional newspapers, in national media such as The Atlantic and Wired.com, and internationally in Brazil, France and the UK. Her photographs of Mola Molas, ocean sunfish, and Valeja Valejas, by the wind sailors, were featured in the BBC's TV programme Nature's Weirdest Events. And her photos and story on killer whales pursuing a dolphin off central California were featured by National Geographic in Carl Safina's Ocean Views blog. Jody also has marine images in permanent collections in the USA and Dominican Republic, including at the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Exploration Center in Santa Cruz, California. With a bachelor's degree and graduate certificate in art photography, Jody's graduate photo project, Our Other Homeless, highlighted the plight of abandoned cats and dogs, euthanized in the thousands by shelters when homes can't be found. Her photographs were incorporated in books and magazines and exhibited from coast to coast. Jody has photographically recorded adventures, people, places and animals across Africa, spanning the continent from Maasai land in Kenya, which she traversed on horseback, to Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia, Zambia, Swaziland and South Africa, capturing an array of incredible animals, including elephants and cheetahs. For the past 7 years, she's focused on marine species of the Monterey Bay in California. And for the last 15 seasons, Jody has been swimming with and photographing the North Atlantic humpback whales in the warm waters of the Silverbank Marine Mammal Sanctuary in the Dominican Republic, where she also helps gather fluke ID photos for research. This non-invasive data collection helps scientists to discover where whales spend their time. Jody has also spent time swimming with and photographing humpback whales in Tonga. Jody's fascinating life has also encompassed organic farming, consulting as an environmental forest and watershed consultant, and training animals. And she'll soon be appearing in Pacific Grove, California, to give a presentation on the not-so-secret lives of humpback whales in their breeding calving grounds. Welcome to the show, Jody.
Thank you, Ruth. Pleasure to be here.
Well, you have an incredible portfolio of fine art photographs that you've taken over many years. I'm wondering if you can remember the first time that art of any kind had a deep effect on you, whether it was a book or a photo, a painting or music, when you realized the power of art to affect us on a deeper level.
Well, I grew up, I was an only child, and I grew up in a family, an extended family, not that I lived with my extended family, but where art was very important. So my mother was She'd thought about majoring in art in school, and she ended up becoming a French teacher, but she got involved in lots of different artistic endeavors. So she became a jeweler. She did some ceramics, and she painted. She did quite a lot of things. So art was, art in a craft sense, was something that we always did at home. And I went to a summer camp as a child where we did that. And I have cousins who are writers and filmmakers and graphic designers and web designers and painters. So art was always given kind of an important place in our family. And my father was very involved in photography. So that was just something that, you know, I did, and, you know, took classes in high school, and had decided, I actually took some photography classes in high school as well, and I had was torn between what I thought was going to the Sorbonne to study art when I went to university, or studying science and biology, and have ended up, you know, going back and forth between the two, and so somehow combining these things.
Yes. So it sounds like growing up that art was just part of your family's life, part of how you express yourself as a human being.
It was. I mean, it was given, you know, it was just something, was always doing craft projects. And, you know, there weren't, you know, artists wouldn't necessarily call them art, but it's how you get started. So, I mean, I had crayons from a very early age, and, you know, would go to summer camp, and my mother often, you know, taught at the camp, and we would do those kinds of projects. And then my father gave me my first Brownie Boxeye camera when I was 12. And even though, you know, there's a debate in the art world, is, you know, photography art or not, it was still, you know, a visual, in this case, a visual field. And I think we did, you know, I did ceramic type things as a child. So it was just something that was part of my life.
Yeah. So how old were you when you first took your first photograph, do you
think? I was probably 12. I started photographing my dog.
Oh. And what interested you about creating images in that way, you know, capturing them in a photograph?
You know, I've given a lot of thought to that sort of retrospectively, because at the time it was just something that was of interest to me, and I've always loved animals, and as much as art was a part of my home life, so were animals. I mean, we had tortoises, and we had parakeets, and I had, you know, a tank full of tropical fish, and I had goldfish before that. And my mother wrote the first definitive handbook on the care and handling of chameleons, because we would go to the county fair every year, and there would be little vendors who would sell these little lizards on a, with like a little leash and a pin, and you would pin it to your shirt. My mother was so upset because people would take them and have no idea how to care for them, so she actually researched it and wrote a booklet that was on how to do that. So that was, you know, that was something that was done. But I think the other factor, which I've thought about retrospectively, is my hearing has never been really good. So it was like the visual channel became very important to me. You know, I dabbled in a lot of different sort of artistic fields. And probably the two that were my most favorite were sculpture and photography. But I didn't really get that feeling for sculpture until I was already at the university.
Right, yeah. So was it your plan to become a professional photographer as a young woman?
No.
You were an actual flower child of the 60s, and in between attending university, I understand, you know, you traveled, you spent some time in England in the 60s and stayed with your cousin Tony and his wife Yoko Ono, and they were heady days by all accounts, with so much hope and passion. What was that experience like, particularly in England, you know, with your cousin?
Well, just to like a little backtrack on that, I mentioned that art and animals were a really important part of my, you know, my immediate family life. So was travel. And my mother had actually been born in London herself, and traveled, you know, came to the States when she was, I think, 9 years old. And so my parents loved traveling. And I had, I believe, gone over on that trip, maybe with my parents, and then split off from my own. And I was in Paris and saw a notice for a film project that was debuting that my cousin had been involved in with his wife at the time, Yoko Ono, and I decided to go to London and visit them. Mm. And it was quite extraordinary because Yoko put me to work doing research for her. Mm. She was working on a hammer and nail project, and she wanted to have this hammer and nail both made out of glass. Mm. But she wanted an authentic model. So I called up, I forget what they called, chemists all throughout the UK, asking if anybody had, because somebody put me onto that, a toffee hammer.
Mm.
And they were, because I'd call and I'd describe it. Oh, you want a toffee hammer? No, haven't seen one of those in years. And, you know, so I was working on that for her. And I remember the living room was all done in white. Everything in the living room was white. And I slept in a bed in the next room that was basically like a double coffin, double-sized mattress coffin. I mean, there was a lid to this box. It was all white, but the lid wasn't on when I slept in it, needless to say.
Right.
So it was very interesting from that standpoint, and I babysat their daughter, who was 5 years old at the time.
Hmm.
And I remember Yoko saying that it was very difficult to stay. I think I was 21, and she didn't know what to do. Because she said my cousin was beating her.
Oh, no.
And all I knew as a young woman was that was unacceptable. Mm. And I said, well, if that's the case, you can't stay. You can't let somebody do that.
No.
So I then went off to Edinburgh, to the Edinburgh Festival, and I went, stopped in Liverpool and met some, you know, musicians there. And when I came back to London, Yoko was not there. At my cousin's, and I said, well, Tony, what happened to Yoko? And he said, oh, she's with John Lennon. And I went, yeah, right. So
you told me before we started that your daughter blames you for breaking up the Beatles.
Exactly. Yeah, she would tell her friends. She said, oh, my mum's responsible for that.
But obviously you did the right thing in telling her to leave. I mean, that's not, even if it was your cousin, it's not acceptable, is it? And also, I think she gets a bad rap because she's a very interesting artist in her own right, I think.
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest from the arts this week, Jodie Fradiani. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Danielle, and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, J.D. Frediani, wildlife photographer extraordinaire. And if you're listening in the Monterey Bay area, I want to let you know that J.D. is going to be in Pacific Grove on Thursday, January 26th, to give a presentation on the not-so-secret lives of humpback whales in their breeding calving grounds. And she's going to be sharing her knowledge and observations gleaned from more than 11 months spent on calving grounds of the North Atlantic and South Pacific humpback whales. So that's 7 o'clock, January the 26th, at the Lecture Hall, Monterey Boat Works, Hopkins Marine Station in Pacific Grove. So I will put information about that on the podcast page, so you can check on itsquestionofbalance.com. Go to Jody's interview and you'll be able to get that information there. But it's a wonderful opportunity to hear some of Jody's experiences and also see some of her amazing photographs that give such a wonderful insight into the lives of these amazing animals. So Jody, you took time out of college twice, I think, at least twice. And there seems such a pressure today on young students in the USA to get to college. You know, life seems to become a bit of a race. A gap year is much more common in Europe. I'm wondering how you think your time out traveling shaped you as a person.
Well, that's a good question. I was torn. I've always admired people who, particularly at an early age, decided there was one thing they wanted to do or be, and they just made that beeline. And that's never been my path. And so when I was getting ready for going to college, and my parents were both absolutely, you know, they were both educated. My mother had a master's degree. My father had basically equivalent to a doctorate. And they, you know, there was no question that I would be going to school, but the question was, what was I going to study? Mm. And it was like, do I want to go to the Sorbonne and study art? Which I decided, among other things, I didn't want to do because I didn't have the self-confidence to put my art, which was very personal, on display and to be critiqued. Or did I want to study science? And I thought I wanted to breed horses, and my mother said, that's a hobby. And I said, okay, I'll be a veterinarian. And I went to UC Davis to study veterinary medicine and found that I was very unhappy with what they did with the animals there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we had a cow with a plastic window in her side, so you could see the organs, you know, functioning. And they had a pack of debarked, irradiated beagles, and so this had no appeal. It was not my vision of what I wanted to do with animals. And I, you know, felt Davis was actually, I'd grown up in the San Fernando Valley, and so Davis was a bit backwards at the time. You know, the dorms were segregated by sexes, and we had to be, freshman women had to be in our dorm rooms at 7:30 at night during the week. So I was not happy there. I left after a year, and I came to UC Santa Cruz. And even there, the biology department, I was a little bit too early, because after I got out, so when marine sciences and ecology sort of became big topics, and some of the top whale researchers got their degrees there. But while I was there, the biology was sort of a lot of the focus was microbiology, which again was not my interest.
Yes.
And because I had done quite a bit of travel with my family already, I really wanted to do that. And it seems in those days that was something that young people often did. Mm. How it impacted me, I went traveling through Europe and actually met the man who became my husband, and had applied. I'd already dropped out of school, I think, once. I had been working in Alan Chadwick's biodynamic intensive French intensive garden. And I had applied to go back to school that fall. And then as we were in Afghanistan on our way to India, I had this like emotional crisis. Do I carry on traveling with this individual, or do I go, you know, this man who I really enjoy being with, or do I go back to school? And we decided to come back. I was not accepted for that fall quarter. They accepted me for winter quarter. And being young and sort of obstinate, I just went, well, that's too bad. I'm not going. And I just, you know, I ended up, having a family and doing a lot of other things for 20 years before the marriage dissolved, and then I went back to school.
Right. Interesting. Your graduate photo project, Our Other Homeless, highlighted the plight of abandoned cats and dogs, as I mentioned in the introduction. And art has been used historically to try to evince social change. Do you feel art has advantages in conveying a social justice message that perhaps other approaches don't?
Definitely. I mean, I think there's, and I've given a lot of thought to this because of my own hearing. And, you know, I see this even on Facebook. There's a message that people will periodically post that say, this is a test. I, you know, want to see if my friends really care if there's no image associated with it. And I don't think it's a matter of caring so much as we're a very visual culture. And I believe, you know, from my understanding, there were other cultures that were much more sort of auditorially focused, and song and the transmission of information through the story, the telling of the story, whereas in our culture, the visual has become so important to the fact that now we do a lot more texting of communication than actually even getting on the phone and talking to people. And so I know with that project that I did where I was... It was actually the director of the Santa Cruz SPCA came to my advisor, my graduate program, looking for someone to do this project, to follow an animal through the process of being relinquished to the shelter and being adopted and being relinquished to the shelter and being euthanized. And my advisor said, well, this sounds like your project. And I, because I had an interest in photographing visceral real life things, like we I had an organic farm at the time, and we would have a butcher come out and butcher the pigs and the goats, and I was fascinated in photographing it and documenting it, because we tend to live a life where we've hidden these things. So I did that project, and you know, some people would not call it art, they would call it documentary photography. There was an exhibit at the Santa Cruz Art League. One of my images was actually, I was asked if I would contribute it to a billboard project throughout Los Angeles to end, or to further the spay-neuter program. And of course I said yes, and then that project got stopped by the LA City Council, and my photograph ended up on page 2 of the Los Angeles Times instead of on billboards. And it created such an uproar. It was photograph of barrels of dead dogs and cats from the walk-in cooler at the shelter, that they talked about it on, you know, became talk show radio topic on KGO. But I also was at the Santa Cruz Art League and watched a group of school children who'd been brought in by their teacher to review the exhibit and take notes. And they were just very matter-of-fact in their observation of it, whereas the people who responded to the photo in the newspaper and the talk show told me I should get a life and how horrible and nobody should have to look at this. And it was like, I actually called in to KGO and said, you know, I think the problem, the reason the adults are having such a hard time is they're the ones who are responsible for this pet overpopulation. So it was very, it definitely hit people in a very visceral place.
Well, it's interesting, people would say we shouldn't have to look at this and not take the next step of we must change this to just, can you not show us it?
Exactly.
You mentioned art photography, and in Castle's Cyclopedia of Photography, art photography is described as when the producer of a given picture has aimed at something more than a merely realistic rendering of the subject and has attempted to convey a personal impression. And certainly images speak to us in a way that words don't, but it seems to me that it's more than just the visual. A good photographer captures an energy of a moment or a person that conveys something beyond the image. And I'm wondering whether that's something you would agree with.
I think so. I mean, I personally think that really wonderful photography, and there's a whole range of it from, you know, the Cartier-Bresson to some of the wildlife photographers who are doing work today, that to me is not just a rendering of something in real life, but there's a sense of design, there's a sense of composition, there's a beauty that's in there. And I really try to do that with my shelter photos, was to make them sort of add, you know, have added value to it in some sense. And yet at the same time, I've had several images accepted into juried art shows, where one was actually done at the Center for Photographic Arts in Carmel, which is all photography, but I've had a couple of images accepted into art shows that include multimedia at the Art League, and those have been a little less representational, or representational but with a question mark as to what you're really looking at. And so I do understand there's this, it's not a line so much as a spectrum.
Yes, yeah, that makes sense. You have an incredible photographic portfolio of African animals. How did you first come to visit Africa?
When I was a child, I had what I call a children's book that was a propaganda book. And I call it propaganda because there was a story in there about a little boy who wouldn't let his mother wash behind his ears. And he went to bed with dirty ears, and in the middle of the night, the little calico, you know, his little calico dog at the foot of his bed, you know, gets up and flaps his ears, and the little boy says, "Where are you going?" And he says, "I'm going around the world." The little boy says, "Can I join you?" Gets on the dog's back, and they fly off. And I remember that they flew over Africa, and he saw the mother elephant washing her baby in the river, and he said, "Oh, please, can we go down? I want to pay with the baby elephant." And the mother said, "No, your ears are dirty." The same thing happened with a hippo, and she said, "No, you can't. Your ears are dirty." So in the morning, he lets his mother wash his ears. But between that and the fact that instead of a teddy bear, I had a stuffed knit elephant as my as my toy, as my little companion, I always wanted to go to Africa.
Yeah.
And in the 90s, I think late 80s and 90s, I was teaching, it's called Tellington Touch, this animal work, training body work with animals. And I jumped at the opportunity to teach in Africa. And as a result, I was able to go there and travel. Actually, the first trip I took to Kenya was before that. But it was with the woman who had developed that animal work, and she was leading a horseback safari. And so that combined multiple passions for me. And then I kept going back, and I was able to actually lead some safaris, take small groups on safari throughout Namibia, and had wonderful experiences and saw amazing wildlife and took photos.
One of the photos you've got is of a cheetah at full pelt. How did you manage to get that image?
Actually, that was at a it was a captive cheetah that had been, I don't remember the story of that exact animal, but had probably been caught in a trap because they thought it was, preying on livestock, or it was a young of an animal that had died, the mother that had died and was unable to survive on its own. And they had a lure course, you know, to exercise the cheetah, because cheetahs run and they tremendous exercise. So that was how I did that.
Capturing animals in their natural setting, I mean, obviously this was a captive cheetah, but when you are taking them in the wild without interfering with them going about their lives, I would think that's quite a challenge. How do you approach taking wildlife photographs? Is it different depending on the country and the environment and the animal?
It definitely is, and I will not, I will say that, you know, I've taken quite a number of photos in Africa, but I don't consider myself, you know, a top land animal photographer, because I've always done it basically on safari. So, you know, for some, say some other purpose, I haven't gone out there in the bush completely focused on photography, but it requires, you know, requires good guides, it requires patience, it requires you know, a whole set of skills. And I have was actually advised to focus on one thing, and because I've had the opportunity to swim with and photograph the humpback whales, and I live on Monterey Bay and have the great opportunity to go out on a whale watch boat here anytime I want, I have tended to spend more of my time and effort photographing whales and other marine mammals and marine animals at this point.
Right, yeah. I mean, my understanding is your focus for the last 7 years has been on marine life, particularly whales. And I've always wanted to swim with whales. It didn't work out the couple of times I've tried to do it, but I have swum with wild dolphins on several occasions, which was amazing. Where whales are so huge. I'm wondering how you go about being around them. Is there risk involved?
You know, I should say there's probably always risk whenever anyone does an outside activity, and probably the biggest risk in swimming with whales is getting on and off the boats.
Right.
The whales are, they're not aggressive, the humpback whales are not aggressive, particularly on their calving grounds. And the whales that we do get in the water with, which are usually mothers and calves, or singers who are single whales who are busy belting out their song. And we have guides with us who are very familiar with the behavior of the whales, and they you know, they tell us where to be and how to behave. We don't reach out and attempt to touch them like they do with the gray whales down in Baja, who, first of all, the people aren't in the water, but those whales really enjoy the physical contact. The humpback whales are not interested. And so, you know, my experience is that the whales themselves are not the danger. You just have to be careful you don't slip when you're getting onto the boat, you know,
right.
That sort of thing.
Yeah. I just remember reading a story about some people with whales. I think they got kind of swatted by one of its, you know, fins by mistake. I mean, obviously it wasn't, you know, attacking them or anything, but when you've got an animal that's that large,
it's possible. I mean, there was one incident a number of years ago where a couple of people got injured, and that was before we actually had guides in the water with us, and it was a mistake on the
yeah.
I mean, no, I shouldn't say a mistake, it was an accident, but I have been sort of smacked by calves on a couple of occasions. They can get a little bit rowdy, but again, it's playful, and it's not with the intent to do damage, because if it was, then
they would do it.
Yeah. They're so much larger. I mean, a calf can be, you know, weigh a ton, you know, when it's quite young, and then they weigh more than that, and I'm real bad at numbers, but I want to say, you know, the whales weigh, you know, 40 tons, something like that.
Wow. Personally, I think it's very important to respect wild animals as individuals. How do you approach your photography so as not to be sort of imposing yourself upon the whales?
I mean, that's a very, very important point. And I know that there are lots of, you know, people who talk about the ethics of wildlife photography and not baiting animals and being incredibly respectful. And I try very hard to do that. In fact, I'm fortunate to live in a country, and we had a patch of sun this week, and I went out, and there was a coyote in my field, and I wanted to go, you know, to my barn, and I saw the coyote was concerned, so I turned around and went back to the house, and then I came back later to get some firewood, and the deer were out there, and I modified what I was doing, because I want them to be unconcerned about me, in part because we share the space together and because I'd also like to photograph them.
Right.
But interestingly, with the whales, you know, when we're photographing topside, we're in a boat, and we try and keep a respectful distance and use a telephoto lens.
Right.
Which, you know, most wildlife photographers do anyways. In fact, some have much more magnification in their lenses than we need out on the water, or that we can actually handle well on a boat.
Yes.
And when we're in the water, we allow the whales to come to us, effectively.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, we learn their behavior, we respect it, we don't position ourselves in front of them. You know, we're usually at the side of the whale if we're in the water for an encounter. We've found sometimes that, you know, there's a mother who doesn't want us behind her, so we'll come around, you know, and it's really about my feeling, attempting to connect with the animal on some level and understand and be perceptive enough to their movements, that we're working with them and not imposing ourselves on them.
Yeah. I mean, I think we just sort of fail to think of them, you know, because of this tendency for humans to see themselves as the pinnacle, you know, of life and all of that. I mean, if you imagine someone just coming up to you and suddenly standing in front of you or touching you and you didn't even know them, it would be completely weird. And yet people, for some reason, think they could just, you know, go up to wild animals, you know, like a dolphin or whatever, and just stroke them. You know, it's strange.
It's unfortunate. And that, I think there are certain programs on TV have encouraged that. And people who aren't thinking have gone out and actually done harm to the animals by approaching them and put themselves in harm's way. I know that the program that I've been involved in, Swimming with the Humpbacks on the Silver Bank, which is a sanctuary, is very well regulated, and we're only allowed to have a certain number of people in the water at a time. We have a guide with us. You know, the guide gets in the water first, checks out the whales. If they seem settled, then, you know, he encourages us to get in, and we approach from a certain way. We try and, you know, keep the noise to a minimum, stay together, and then we just float on the surface. We're not allowed to dive. You know, if the whales want to get away, they can stay below us. And we find, what I'm finding over the years now is that the whales seem to be actually more comfortable with the people. And I think because the swim program there has gone on for over 25 years now, that what's happening is some of the moms who are coming back with their calves were calves themselves in the swim program beginning.
Yeah.
And I, with my colleagues, Jean Flipsey and Jeff Pantahoff from Conscious Breath Adventures, and I basically pioneered whale identification from underwater photos. I mean, people have been figured that out in the 1970s, that if you photographed the underside of the fluke of a humpback whale, that you could identify them because they're individual, fingerprints, and have been doing that. But the mothers are in shallow water, and they don't do deep dives, so their flukes rarely come out of the water. And we were able to actually photograph these flukes underwater and begin to have an identification, and then sent those to Allied Whale at the College of Atlantic up in Maine, that keeps a comprehensive catalog of all the North Atlantic whales, and identify some of these individuals and where they feed. So the first mother we photographed underwater was a whale named Spoon, who's very well known on the Stellwagen Bank off the coast of New England, and in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Her portrait's painted on the dock. Lots of people know her. She's part of an Adopt-a-Whale program. You know, you can pay some money and help support, you know, some of the research.
Yeah.
And she's a very laid-back, relaxed whale. And, you know, we actually just saw her calf last season, which means she was there. We didn't get a chance to see her, but there was a calf who was, you know, bouncing around on the surface, and we took photos and got a fluke photo and sent that, and they said, oh, that's Spoon's calf from 2015. That was actually 2 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, that's
so
lovely.
Yeah. So it's, you know, these are whales that actually know people. They're well known because they go back to the same feeding area each year, up north. And I actually did a scientific poster on repeat and extended encounters with humans on the calving grounds, which is basically not all the whales that are out there are interested in having anything to do with humans. And a lot of them we'll see week after week. And we've actually had moms come over to our dive boat, which is where we're based when we're out there, in the morning when we're getting ready to get into our little tenders, our small boats. And it's almost as if they're saying, okay, Junior, you're going to play with the people today while I rest.
Oh, that's funny. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest this week, Jody Frediani, marine life photographer. We're going to break now, but we'll be back soon after these messages.
like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com. It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Special guest from the arts this week, marine life photographer Jodi Fradiani. And just wanted to remind you again, if you're listening in the Monterey Bay area, Jodi's going to be in Pacific Grove on Thursday, January the 26th, to give a presentation of the not-so-secret lives of humpback whales in their breeding calving grounds. And she'll be showing her photographs and talking about her experiences. So that's January the 26th at the Monterey Boatworks here in California. So I will put information about that on the podcast page if you want to check it out. So, Jodi, I was wondering, as well as the physical challenges of being around such large animals as whales, I'm wondering about equipment challenges. You know, your photos are so crisp and light and evocative. I'm just wondering how that's even possible under the water. I mean, they really are truly amazing.
So thank you. And I will say, yes, there are two challenges. There are multiple challenges. And the first one I wanted to say is that when I began to swim with the humpbacks, I would go out, and sometimes the name is a misnomer because we're not really swimming with the whales. Mm. We're swimming up to the whales, and
right.
then we're resting with them.
Yes.
But even that, I found that I would come back to the boat, and I would fall asleep. And so since then, I've begun swimming during the year. And
right.
so I swim a mile every week. So
wow.
I can stay in physical shape, so I can have... One doesn't need to do that to swim with them, but that gives me a much better experience.
Right.
As far as the equipment, it's been a slow development process. The first time I did this, I went for a week, and... You know, an underwater housing is quite expensive, and I thought, that's a lot of money to shell out for 1 week. So
yeah.
I bought myself a $15 disposable underwater camera.
Wow.
And I actually got two images that were decent from that week, and one of them won second place at a American Cetacean Society National, you know, photo contest. And I decided that I had to do this again, and it was the old, if I do it again, I'm going to need to have better equipment, and if I have better equipment, I'm going to need to do it more often.
Yes.
And so I gradually upgraded from that disposable camera to what I call a plastic bag underwater housing, which wasn't very effective, to a better housing, to a better camera, to a better lens. And, you know, talking to other people who are doing underwater photography and just, you know, looking at my budget and each time upgrading so that the quality of my images, you know, continues to improve from that standpoint.
Yes.
But it's different. And then I was just in preparing for the presentation that I'm going to do at the end of January. I've gone back through quite a lot of my images, you know, back the last 10 years, and the quality has improved quite a lot over time.
Well, I was interested to see when I was researching you that quite a lot of the national papers in Britain have featured your photographs. So certainly, I think marine life, particularly whales and dolphins, are very fascinating to a lot of people. And I always think it's heartbreaking to see whales and dolphins in captivity, you know, animals whose normal territory ranges over hundreds of square miles, kept in tanks and pools. And I'm wondering whether you have any impetus through your work to highlight the need for these animals to be free.
You know, I don't spend a lot of time talking about that, although I did bring that up recently in a newspaper interview, in part because the editor was concerned that, you know, an image of a killer whale actually tossing a dolphin, you know, through the air might be disturbing to people.
Yes.
And I said, well, you know, your paper has done this before. And to me, you know, taking, you know, because he was concerned about children, and I said, this is real life, and these animals are doing this to make a living. This is how they eat.
Yeah.
And you know, I didn't go into some of the detail here, but I said what's really disturbing to me is taking children to see, you know, captive cetaceans or whales and dolphins, particularly killer whales that, or, you know, we call them orca, that are taken from their families. And they live in very strong family units for years. I mean, Granny is resident orca from up north, Vancouver Island area, just passed, and they believe she was 102 years old, and she was the matriarch of that family. And so when you take, you know, these animals who were basically stolen from their families, and you put them in a very small tank for years, and sometimes with other whales who are not part of their family, which is very difficult for them to just get along, and you prevent them from this extensive travel that they're used to doing, that to me is the tragedy.
Yes.
So, you know, I will bring it up when it's important. I shouldn't say when it's important, when it's appropriate.
Well, I think, you know, for me, that's where art is interesting, because in a way you don't need to say anything. I mean, by putting out the images that you have, one would hope that people see the majesty and the amazing lives they live out in the wild in such huge spaces, and that hopefully people might make some connection to that. Doesn't seem right that they're flipping about in a pool having some fish given to them, you know?
Yeah, I agree completely. And in fact, I do, because I have the opportunity, I go out with Monterey Bay Whale Watch on the bay out of Monterey on a regular basis, and then I will post some of the photos from my trip on their Facebook page, and people, you know, will constantly comment and, you know, be so thankful that they get to see what these animals are doing when they're free and wild. And so that topic is very much on people's minds as a result of some of the documentaries and the books and things that have been out there recently.
We humans generally think of ourselves as being more developed and evolved than whales and dolphins, but we're judging them by our own criteria, and I often wonder whether they might not be more evolved, you know, living in peace and community and possibly communicating in ways we don't even understand. Is this something you think about at all?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, in preparing this presentation on the humpback whales, you know, so much of their lives is a mystery to us, in spite of the fact that, you know, we're able to tag them and, you know, be able to see the route that they travel across the Atlantic Ocean or, you know, the Pacific Ocean. There have been researchers who have been able to follow some of the resident orcas, the ones who eat salmon, for years, because they spend a lot of time in a very concentrated area that's accessible. And they have highly evolved, you know, cultures. The same thing with sperm whales. There have been some researchers who've been able to study them, and they've got very extensive families, and they have dialects, and they have culture, and they haven't destroyed their environment. It's
we're
the ones who have taken the fish and, you know, done the things that are damaging to them. So, you know, depending on your definition of evolved, I would have to say that, you know, they get some really strong points for, you know, living very successfully and in a way that is very harmonious and not damaging to their environment and to other species.
Yes, yeah, and living peaceably, you know, for the most part, and in loving relationships, you know, I mean, and for most of us, that's probably what our basic aspirations are, isn't it? To be loved and love and be at peace, you know, so... In that sense, they've got it all going on, haven't they?
They're something that we could learn from them. This is true. A lot, I'm afraid.
Well, thank you so much, Jodie, for coming into the studio. It's been amazing talking to you. And I will put up quite a few of Jodie's photographs on the podcast page and give you a link to her website so that you can go and look at her amazing work. It is truly inspiring. And as I said, if you are in this area or you fancy traveling to this area to see Jodie's presentation, it's on the 26th of January. It's called The Not-So-Secret Lives of Humpback Whales in Their Breeding Calving Grounds. And if you come, you'll learn about competitive rowdy groups, dancing whales, singers, and what moms and cars do during those long months when mom undertakes a total fast while she's nursing junior. So if you are in this area, I would encourage you to go to that January 26th, Monterey Boat Works, 7 p.m. And if you can't remember that because you're driving or whatever, look on the podcast page on itsaquestionofbalance.com. And I also want to encourage you to go to the website and check out previous podcasts. If you enjoy this interview, you tell your friends and they can go to the website and be able to listen at their convenience. And as I mentioned earlier, I have had some really, really interesting guests and some also very thought-provoking topics. So thank you so much again, Jodie. It's been really lovely having you.
Thank you, Ruth. It's been fun.
Great. All right. Well, again, thanks for listening. Remember, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. I will see you next time.